honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Jerry Deitch of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Brooklyn, New York. On June 6, 1944, he came ashore at Utah Beach with Naval Combat Demolition Unit 30. His helmet would save his life when a piece of shrapnel sent him to the ground, but merely dented that metal on his head. After returning from Europe, he trained with Underwater Demolition Team 24, and he was one of those UDT-24 frogmen who left Maui in July 1945, headed for Japan.
What happened was we were getting ready to invade. We were getting to invade, and all of a sudden, we got it on the radio that MacArthur was on his way to Japan to sign a peace treaty. So we kept going, and we went to Hokkaido, which is northern part of Japan, which I mentioned before, 85 miles south of Vladivostok, Russia. It was summertime, but it was freezing. Of course, we were so far close to Siberia. And we went in. There were two of us that went in. With no guns. We just had a knife on us. And we went in with a rubber boat to see if there were roads that where they led, if they led across the island. So he went looking there, and I stayed on the beach, and I saw this tall Japanese guy. And the reason he's tall, I found out later on, was because the Russians came down from Siberia, and they were playing around. And they were tall Japanese. He was tall, and I was trying to motion and make friends. I went and made like an airplane, and he showed me, he pointed, and there was a bomber that was shot down on the first raid to Tokyo. So I don't know what happened. I never saw a tall one before, and he had a big, I forget what you call it, that they cleared the, I forget what you call it, that they cleared the...
A sickle or something?
Yeah, something like that. And he was holding it in his hand. Now, I was of no danger. I didn't have, and my buddy was looking for a road. So I said, arigato. I said the few words that they told us in Japanese. And when I said arigato to him, and I bowed down, so he smiled at me. But I didn't know what I was going to do. All I had was a knife, and he held it up like this. And he bowed back down to me. And that was it. Then my buddy came back, and... we got what we wanted to know. We drew a drawing of the beach and how it was, and we left there. I never got back to Hokkaido again. However, I'm missing a very important point. When my team came ashore in Hokkaido, they found a barge loaded with ammunition. So they hooked it onto one of the boats, and my executive officer got in the boat that was going to tow it out to sea. He got in. And we, with our rubber boat, we were about 100 yards behind him. And he was taking it back. And all of a sudden, there was a big explosion. He was helicoptered out. I don't know what happened to him. Barely injured. Now, you would know the name. He was Otto Graham's brother. You remember Otto Graham, the football player?
Yeah, quarterback of the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, he was his brother. At that time, he was in college.
What ended up happening to him?
Badly hurt. I don't know. We never got any news. Helicoptered him into a hospital someplace.
So this is after your reconnaissance mission, after you'd scouted it out, so your unit comes ashore and they find this Japanese ammunition. Do you think it was booby-trapped? Is that why it went off?
It had to be.
And how long did you stay there?
We stayed there 2 days.
And was that
it? We know that our exec was taken to a hospital. That's all.
And did you get to come home after that?
2 months later.
Well, given those thoughts you'd had of... I'm never going to see my family again. I'm never going to see my friends again. What was it like to finally come back to the States?
Well, first of all, as soon as the war ended, you know, we knew it was over. That's it. You know, great. I'm going back. I'm going home, you know.
Do you remember what it was like to come back home?
I was in a happy shock.
So you had floated that idea of marrying Selma when you were back on leave. So what happened once you got back?
We went out a few times. And a few times I said, let's get married. She said, not yet. I said, okay. I said, because I'm still in the service and I got to get a job and doing it. Once I get a job, I'll ask you again. And I went for about 6 months and I said, are you ready now? And she says, yep.
And that was 71 years ago.
Yeah.
So what's the secret to being married for 71 years and still getting along?
Two words. I'm not a comic. Yes, dear.
How long did it take you to figure that out, though?
Immediately.
Well, and, you know, with regard to what you did in the war, again, this was a real unique duty that you had, that very few people had in the war, that very few people knew about, that would lead to so much more now. You paved the way for the SEALs of today. Yeah. Are there other things you look back on and you say, you know, that was really dangerous, or that could have been it for me, or that was a really unique thing to be doing?
You know, it was really a unique thing. But when you're that age, you are on your mind is not me. I'm indestructible. And I spoke to a lot of young guys who felt the same way. They may have changed when the first time that they went into combat. They say, you know, maybe I'm wrong. This is not a, you're not playing a game.
And on June 6th, half of your group goes to Omaha Beach. The other half goes to Utah Beach. And I think you said there are about 24 that were killed in Omaha Beach and three at Utah Beach, including one standing right next to you. How often over the years have you thought about the guys who didn't get to come home like you did, who didn't get to get married and have a family and have the career?
I would say for the first 10, 12 years, I there wasn't a month that went by where I didn't have some sort of nightmare.
Did you lose anyone that you were particularly close to?
He was a Marine. We grew up together. He was killed on Iwo. And after being wounded, he went back again. And we grew up together, went to school together.
What was his name?
Hoffman.
Well, and one of the reasons I ask is I know that not only are you going to be honored by the French consulate here on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, but you're also going to be taking a trip with Honor Flight Southern Nevada to Washington, D.C., to the National World War II Memorial. And there they have a wall of gold stars, and it signifies 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. What do you think is going to be on your mind when you look at that?
It's going to take me back. I'll be sad. I'll be happy that I was there looking at them. I'll be praying for their souls. I'm not an overly religious person, but I believe in God.
Well, and in light of that, are there things you look at, parts of your story, decisions that were made, being in the right place at the right time, being knocked out but not killed? Are there moments maybe different from that you look at and you say, well, that God I believe in was looking out for me?
Yeah, I believe in faith. I really do. You know, I'll say, I always believed. I said, it wasn't my time. I could say that I'm not religious, but to a point, I probably am. And it wasn't my time.
And for the guys who didn't get to make it back, who are honored there in Washington, D.C., who are in your memories, your friend Hoffman you just told me about, who died at Iwo Jima, how should those Americans be remembered all these years later? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
You know, that's a part of history that should never, ever, ever be forgotten. And they should always be remembered. Because most of them were very, very young men.
And you're done with the war. You and Selma get married. Here you are still married 71 years later. You had a couple kids, 4 grandkids, 8 great-grandkids. And you said growing up you had thought about being an engineer. When you got out of the service, you wanted to work for the NYPD. Is that true?
Yes. In the worst way, I said, I know all about it. I could. I'm good with guns. I'm good with this, that. But it was, I never realized you had to be a certain height. And I said, I was good enough to be in combat, but I'm not good enough to be in the police force. And when I seen this relative of mine, 5'3", and she gets in, as soon as she graduated, this is in New York, she went ahead and captured a guy. Her partner was on the other side of the street. At that time, they wore big, long coats. And with all the equipment, she couldn't get her radio out. And she tackled a guy that was 6 foot tall. Wow. Tackled him. He robbed a store. She tackled him and handcuffed him. And she couldn't get her radio to call her partner to come across the street.
So she's 5'3", and she's with the NYPD now. But back
then,
Just retired. Yeah. But they told you you're too short?
Yep.
So what'd you end up doing?
I went to the fire department to see if I could get it done. They said, no, you got to be a fireman, period. I said, no. They would have taken me, but I'm fiercely afraid of fire.
You ended up being a paramedic?
Yeah, 15 years, and I was an instructor at a medical school, Albert Einstein Medical School, teaching emergency medicine to second-year students who wanted to work on a, you know, in an emergency room when they were off. It's a different kind of medicine.
And when you moved here to Las Vegas, you decided you wanted to be a part of the police department here?
Yeah, I wanted to do everything that I could. I volunteered for security force here. I volunteered with the police department. That's it. I used to do handicap parking, and I gave it up because you went from a air-conditioned car outside to write a ticket back into the air-conditioned car. I ended up one cold after another. Then I heard about the McCarran Airport. So I went ahead and I tried for that. They said, sure, we'll be glad to have you. So I've been there 12 years. I pick my days. I pick my hours. I do any one of them.
And what do you do?
I help people out, keep my eyes and ears open. Of course, it's a dangerous time, unfortunately. And anything suspicious, we don't go after somebody. We take our radio. Within a minute, we got policemen coming down, armed policemen. We're not supposed to. We follow somebody, but never get close enough for them to see you following them.
Well, I'd say tell us what days you work and where in the airport you are, but I don't want someone distracting you from that job because that sounds like you have to be pretty alert.
Yeah, we are. We are, you know. I stay in the baggage. I used to be all around, but now I stay in the baggage department and keep an eye out. Stolen luggage is the biggest thing.
How can you tell?
They're suspicious looking, but you can't go over and say, all you do is you pick up, somebody looks a little suspicious, say, by the way, can I see your luggage tag? Because all luggage looks alike. I want to see if this matches. You're very, very calm and nicely and respectful.
How long are you going to keep doing that?
My captain said, you're the oldest one here, and you're the oldest one driving the car. And I wish some of my policemen would drive as good as you.
So you don't have any plans to cut that out?
No plans. As long as I could walk, and I don't stand still, I'm constantly walking. I start in the morning, 5-6 hours later, I sit down for lunch. I don't want to get up. But otherwise, I'm on my feet all the time. I clock myself and sort of do about 10 miles a day.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I don't want to forget either to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. Is there something you'd say as you approach that 93rd birthday that you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
My family, my children, my grandchildren. I'm blessed. I have nothing else. You know, I have everything. I'm healthy. I don't want to be a burden to anybody. We're active. My wife and I are active. My wife was a walker with me, but you see, she has a walker. She fell back and busted her back on her birthday, June 24th. We used to walk a mile, 2 miles every day. We're very fortunate.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know or understand?
No, I'm thankful. I'm very, very thankful.
And of course, we are thankful for the privilege of spending this hour with Jerry Deitch. Such a treat to meet his wife of 71 years, Selma, as well. You'll find their wedding photo online at hometownheroesradio.com. And as a postscript, you heard Jerry mention the incident off of Hokkaido when the ammunition blew up and wounded an officer who was the brother of Football Hall of Famer Otto Graham. As Jerry said, Otto was in college for most of the war. He was a football and basketball star at Northwestern. Otto Graham entered the Navy's V-5 program and trained as a pilot. And later on, Graham would become the football coach and eventually athletic director at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. As for his brother, Vic Graham, he did survive that incident that Jerry recalled. Vic went on to marry and have 3 children. He watched many of his brother's championship games in person, and he passed away in 1998 at the age of 75. Jerry Deitch is looking forward to his 93rd birthday this April, so if you happen to see him around baggage claim at the McCarran International Airport, say hello and thank him for serving our country. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.